This is CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life, with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is the Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. Alongside me today, Lionel Makokotlelo. Welcome, Lions.
Dumela, Gary, and dumela to our podcasters and everybody who's listening to us this morning. Afternoon.
Today's show is about police assault and brutality and wrongful and unlawful arrest and detention.
You?
With us in studio to discuss police misconduct and abuse are specialist attorneys on the subject, Tim Flock, Jean-Ray Pierton, and candidate attorney Anne Nzirabira. I may get it wrong, she'll correct me later. They're all from the lawyers, attorneys firm Guildenhuys Malatsi. They're based in Pretoria and Sandton. They have extensive experience in taking up claims against the police. Now, one of the claims they successfully handled against the police was on behalf of a man, listen to this one, who was arrested and assaulted for not wearing a shirt in public. And the question is, why wasn't he?
Oh, my shirt, 264, shirt, so sexy, yeah.
I'm too sexy for your party.
Well, there we go, Lions. I think he was too sexy for his shirt. He must have been scared shirtless after that one. What can I say? That's I'm Too Sexy by British group Right Said Fred. Older listeners may remember that one. It's from the early 90s. It reached number one in the USA. The syrupy I Do It For You by Bryan Adams, which is not my favorite, held this one back from being number one in the UK.
Well,
there you go. Now, before Lionel takes off his shirt, let's give it our contact details. Our Facebook page, The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg. And Lionel, you want to give out our Twitter handle?
Our Twitter handle is at Hertzlaw, H-E-R-T-Z-L-A-W. You should know that by now.
H-E-R-T-Z-L-A-W is our Twitter handle. Have a look at our Facebook page, if you don't mind, and give us a like. We're going to be taking your questions during the show. The questions come up from our collaborative partner, Legal Talk South Africa, and they are right now one of the biggest Facebook groups in South Africa. Amazing.
Amazing grace. Amazing indeed.
We have a compliment from two great listeners of ours. It's Kerry Duran and Inge Oosthuizen. They're in Umhlanga, and they said they don't miss one of our shows. They download each one onto the app on their phone, and they listen in their cars. They love it.
Oh, no, thank you guys.
Nice to hear, isn't it?
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Kerry Duran and Inge Oosthuizen, we've doubled our listenership lines.
Now we're growing nationally.
Welcome to our attorneys here in studio. Tim's leading the group, Tim Flock. And you, Tim, I know you handled you represented the guy who was arrested and assaulted for not wearing a shirt in public. The question is, was he too sexy for his shirt? Tell us a bit about that case. What went on there?
Well, firstly, thank you very much for having us on the show and to you and your listeners. I guess it would depend on if you asked him how he felt at that point in time. Yeah. But the long and the short of the whole story was that he'd gone out with a couple of friends. And it was a very hot summer's night in the Limpopo province. And, you know, he wanted to go in and get himself a cool drink at a garage store. And him and his friends, as they pulled up there, he got out. And he actually noticed a bunch of drug dealers at the garage store itself. And he got upset. You know, he wanted to take them on. And so he was making a little bit of a racket. And be it as it may, the manager took a little bit of exception, phoned the police. As they arrived on the scene, they said to him, "Why are you not wearing a shirt?" And he said, "Well, you know, it's about 36 degrees, so you know, it's a little bit on the hot side of things." And a little bit of an argument ensued, and yeah, they got a bit hot under the collar, pardon the pun, but yeah, things escalated, and he was assaulted, and ultimately arrested and detained for not wearing a shirt in public.
The question is, Tim, when is it acceptable for a man to go topless? I mean, if I walk around Sandton City Shopping Mall, can I take my shirt off?
Well, you know, by the same...
Not about me, but somebody who's got the right to, yeah.
By the same argument, you know, you could say that all the people at the beach should be arrested because none of them are wearing, you know, shirts.
Yeah, but that's expected.
Yes.
Is it expected? I mean, how would the average person feel if they in one of those little, what do you call them?
Speedo?
No, at the garage, they have these little cafes or whatever they're called, the shops, and the public walks in all the time without shirts. Would that not offend anyone?
Not in terms of our law in any case. You are allowed to walk in public without a shirt. It would probably be frowned upon by and large. I mean, you know, there's what the law says, and then there's probably what you would have your moral obligation towards the public. But, you know, from a legal point of view, there's certainly nothing that prevents you from doing that.
Tim, I saw something interesting. There was a man who stood naked on Trafalgar Square, the plinth there, and he was not, according to their law in the UK, he was not breaking the law. Yeah, it's not an offence to be naked in public in England and Wales, but it becomes an offence when you intend to upset and shock someone. So I think the way the law reads in both their law, country and ours, if you outraging someone's sense of decency, it could well be, I mean, they've got to come to court, the complainant, and show how it offended them.
Yes.
And whether the man's naked top is offensive to them. I guess in certain circumstances it could be offensive.
It can. I mean, it depends on, you know, by and large in South African law on, you know, the values of the community.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've just described the difference overseas. And I think in South Africa there's a little bit more conservativeness insofar as that specific aspect is concerned.
Yeah.
And hence, you know, we follow a system that rather tries to implement a scenario where you don't have that openness to appear naked in public. It's just basically set in our law for quite some time.
I guess that the owner of the establishment, any establishment, has the right to turn people away. And you could say, if you don't put your shirt on, get out of here. That's his right, isn't it?
That's correct. You can definitely do that.
Yeah. So there, the person without the shirt has got no right to say, I insist on being here, because it's obvious. There's a right reserved to the owner of the establishment. The person was arrested, this very guy who didn't have a shirt, and he was assaulted as well, or just what did they do to him?
The irony of the situation was that they told him to put his shirt back on, which he then did,
yeah.
And they then subsequently proceeded to assault him after he put his shirt on. So
he didn't look so menacing with his shirt on, yeah.
Well, it got torn off again in any event, so he would have probably had to be arrested twice for not wearing a shirt.
So they, what did they drag him, shove him into a police vehicle and drag him to the police station?
They wanted to force him into the police van, and he couldn't understand, you know, why he's being arrested for not wearing a shirt, and obviously complying with their request that, you know, he put one back on. And he was then, you know, fully within his right to resist such an arrest, and ultimately there was a scuffle that ensued, and a number of officers were involved, and he got dragged a little bit on the ground, you know, and then obviously bumped around a little bit in the police van as well.
He was then detained in the police cells.
Yes, that's correct.
When we talk police cells, are we talking, was he on his own, or was he with other dangerous people?
He was with quite a number of other prisoners. Whether or not they were dangerous is another topic. But what's interesting
is... Well, by its nature, to be locked up with people who are there for maybe hijacking or robbery or rape or anything is the last thing any of us want to, God forbid, be in.
Yes. Yeah. No, well, what's interesting is that he said that he purchased cigarettes for the guys who were in the cells, and because of that, they subsequently left him alone. Whether or not that's true is another story.
I would be inclined to believe it was true. Right? Give me smokes or else...
True. That's the case. That's how you actually negotiate your way around prison. You've got to have a bit of something to offer.
How long did he spend there, Tim?
So he spent about 15 hours from the date, from the time of his arrest until he was released.
Do some of these people explain the conditions of these police cells to you? And I know you do a lot of it. And you want to tell us what they report to you? I mean, is this across the board, or is it only in certain police cells, or what is the general report?
I haven't sat in on many of the consultations, but I do read many of the consultation notes after the fact. And from what I know, it would be the standard conditions which you would expect in an environment such as that. Cold, blankets aren't provided. Obviously, if you're there for an extended period of time, food then becomes an issue. Yeah. The size of the cells is often an issue as well, and how many prisoners or inmates, if you will, are in that cell. And
Jean Ray, do you know any reports on these things?
Yeah, I've gotten a couple of shocking accounts of the conditions there in the police cells. So luckily we can say it as it is on this show. I mean, they write on the walls with the only material they have available to them.
Mm.
And it's very unsettling to most of our clients who are law-abiding citizens by nature and who shouldn't be in those cells. And it causes them a great deal of distress, because when one looks at the period of detainment that they are detained, they do need to eat, obviously, and they do need water. And when those are provided, they are provided in the front part of the cell. And the prisoners who are there the longest just grab it. And most of the time you would find that your client would come to you and say to you, listen, I haven't eaten for 3 days. I haven't had water for 3 days.
Wow.
And it's compounded by how Anne correctly stated that you don't have a blanket, you don't have a mattress, you're lying on a cold floor. Most of our clients also need medical attention because they were assaulted and they were treated badly. And I mean, I understand and I feel for my clients when they come to us with these stories and they explain to us. It's just the cumulative effect of all the conditions makes it bad.
Any guy who's detained is entitled to be compensated for the damage he suffers to his well-being, to his emotional well-being, to everything.
Yeah.
And it's frightening to be in those conditions, isn't
it? Yes, that's 100% correct. And what's unfortunate for the minister, who's the person who in the actual fact pays the amount of damages, he needs to take his victim as he finds him.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a sensitive person that's detained and they have a psychological breakdown that causes a lesion that affects them in their everyday life, I mean, they're entitled to be compensated for that in the end.
Good point.
Yeah, and to add on just to what Johnny was saying in terms of most of the people who are detained do require medical treatment. The other day we were dealing with a case where one of our clients had been shot in the nuts, and he had been detained without seeing any doctor up until his release, and he was detained for about 4 to 5 days.
Obviously, we argued for the maximum compensation.
Yeah.
You went nuts on that one, I guess.
But, Gary, I just want to find out, how do you quantify the amount of this?
We're going to come to that, Lance. Oh, okay. We're going to come at it. It's a very good question. I just want to deal with the shirtless guy.
You are so obsessed with the shirtless.
Well, I'll tell you why, because it's got some kind of happy ending or so. The police then wanted to prosecute, or they didn't prosecute, or what went on with this case?
So after he was released, after the 15 hours of his detention, he was then given a warning to appear in court, and he subsequently appeared on no less than 4 occasions. This was for further investigations and for representations to be made to the state prosecutor. Mm. Now, these representations were to the effect that, you know, he hadn't committed an offence and that there was no prospect of actually pursuing a prosecution against him.
So they actually threw in the towel, the police and the National Prosecuting Authority.
So just to be clear on this point, yeah. The police are responsible for your first appearance at court.
Yes.
Thereafter, if the prosecutor insists on a postponement, they are then the responsible entity. So what happened was that the prosecutor, after receiving the representations, decided to withdraw the case against Mr. Van Heerden.
He's the shirtless guy.
That's the shirtless
okay,
guy.
Okay, I have the letter from the National Prosecution Service in which they say, take notice, this office has considered your representations, that's the attorney's representations, after perusing the case docket, it's been established that there was no offense on which the accused could have been arrested.
Mm.
And therefore, it says it can be concluded that he was evading an unlawful arrest. I don't know what that means. But the fact is, they decided that the case would be withdrawn at court.
Mm,
and,
yes.
and nothing ever happened. That was the end of that.
Yes.
Wow. Your client then says, hold on a second, you're not going to get away that lightly. You've punished me, you hurt me, you locked me up, you assaulted me. I want to sue you. And that's what he did through you people.
That's correct.
Cool. Let's talk about this offense happened. Do you remember the dates, really? When did it happen that he was arrested?
I believe it was in October 2015, November 2015, sorry, I could be mistaken.
You then sued the Minister of Police and National Prosecuting Authority.
That's
you
right.
You sued both of them.
Yes.
Do you remember how much you sued for?
You know, just before I go into that, you know, it's always a rough estimate at the point that we issue summons. I think it's important for the listeners to know that, because we often have, you know, clients saying, well, you issued summons for R1 million, but I only ended up getting 100,000.
Yes.
So, you know, it's just to get the legal proceedings really underway and get the matter going, so to speak, because they do take a long time.
Absolutely.
So I know that, for example, in this case, I think we claimed for 400,000 or 500,000.
Well, you broke it down under three headings. The first was you claimed claim one, unlawful arrest and detention.
Mm.
Your second claim was for, let me just have a look. You claimed 150,000 for that. And then you claimed assault, your claim two, and you claimed for medical expenses and all kinds of things, general damages for pain and suffering. And the total claim there, I think, came to 150,000 or something. And then you claimed another for malicious prosecution. You claimed a similar amount. And the matter, did it go to court or was it settled before it went to court?
It went the full distance. Mm. Insofar as we had to issue summons, the state attorney who was representing the Minister of Police and the National Director of Public Prosecutions defended the case. They filed a plea. We had a pre-trial. We went through the whole discovery process. And, we had to, on the day of trial, was when they actually came and conceded that they were liable.
Okay, so what they do is they run this thing all the way, from the beginning, all the way to trial. So what in effect is happening is that the legal costs are going sky high.
Mm.
Yeah.
The question to you, Jean-Ré, is why do they run it? I mean, they withdrew this case right up front. Why didn't they sit around a table with you, say, guys, let's talk settlement. You want X, let's talk. And avoid all the legal fees that you and I are paying for when the state attorney is defending this.
Yes, in a perfect world, Gary, that would be the ideal, to settle matters early and out of court to cut the legal costs. But unfortunately, we are dealing with a number of role players. You've mentioned the state attorney correctly, who's the lawyer for the state. Then you are dealing with the Minister of Police and the National Director of Public Prosecutions, who all need to give instructions, and where there are legal advisors who have to consider the matters. But as we have experienced, the state attorneys have an immense caseload. I mean, each state attorney, if my information from dealing with them is correct, they have about 700 to 800 files each. And this is not files limited to unlawful arrest and detention. This is everything from land claims to straight through to the matter where we were involved in the Constitutional Court for the Sasa case. they are extremely busy and they simply do not have the time to afford the matter the proper attention. And unfortunately, we have to protect our clients' rights and drive the matter to court, because as you guys have correctly stated, that's usually where they settle or decide to run the trial in the end.
Let me ask you guys this question. If you sue the state, the Minister of Justice, whoever it may be, the Minister of Police, whoever, can they only use a state attorney or can they use outside attorneys? Do you know the answer to that?
It depends on the matter, and it also depends on the quantum of the matter.
Yeah.
If it's a really, really big case, I have seen where there are a really big police assault cases where a person, for instance, gets shot in the stomach and he needs severe medical attention to and corrective surgery to correct everything that went wrong afterwards. Then they farm it out to attorneys that are on their panel. But these run-of-the-mill cases usually don't go to other attorneys, because they are supposed to be handled by the state attorney.
Does the state attorney charge a fee to the minister, or does he work on a salary? And
He works on a salary and he gets a state pension.
So there's no fees that the minister pays. That's why he wants to use the state attorney.
That's correct. That's
what
correct.
Is in effect happening is that the matter is running all the way to trial, and your fees are running up all the time, and you guys, we all expensive, us lawyers. Therefore, the state, when they concede at the day of the trial, they have to pay all your legal fees, and that's running into tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands.
Yeah. Wow. That's correct.
And that's what we, as the public, are paying. It's our tax money.
Yes.
It may, I mean, if the state is that busy, it may pay them to farm out these matters as well and get outside lawyers to try and resolve them quickly.
Well, Gary, just on that, I know that, for example, in the Eastern Cape, the state attorney has now just recently, with regards to medical negligence matters against the MEC of Health, they've started to outsource those matters to private law firms, you know, to assist them and obviously also to investigate whether or not there are legitimate claims or not.
Tim, you sent me an article which I really enjoyed looking at. It says that the state attorneys are drowning, that's the word, under massive workload. Was this the Sunday Times article, or I'm not sure where it came from?
It was the legal brief. It was from the Sunday Times, and we obviously got it in
our The state attorneys are drowning in workload of hundreds of cases, as you rightly say. According to 2016 Public Service Commission report, the working conditions, and this was about KZN in KwaZulu-Natal, and that's mirrored in the rest of South Africa. Experts say that, and these are the figures, these state attorneys sometimes reach 2,487. What's this? Experts say that to reach an acceptable standard for the caseload of state attorneys, 2,487 attorneys would be needed. So they need 2,500 state attorneys in KwaZulu-Natal at certain times to handle 248,000 files. In fairness to them.
Yes.
Okay, and how many have they got? Like 300?
Yeah.
So, I mean, can you work this one out? It's crazy. There are a lot of lawyers in South Africa in private practice that are struggling. Recently admitted attorneys, young lawyers, not big firms like Hildenes Malachi, but there are young lawyers out there that need work. And I don't know why they don't use these guys to help. It should be, rather than allow these matters to run all the way to trial. I'm making a noise here, but I think, I hope it gets to someone's ears. I'm sure they know about it. Maybe the Law Society should try and push this one as well. I really feel strongly about this. I know we do, we've been doing a lot of radio shows with the Attorneys Fidelity Fund. There are lawyers that unfortunately have been dipping into clients' money and running away with their clients' money. And it often comes from struggle. They just, you know, they think, they'll dip their hands in and they'll pay it back next month, but they can't next month, and it's because they're sickling. So there you go, guys. It's just a thought. Okay, we have a number of questions that have come from our legal collaborative partner, and I just want to pull them up, and I'm going to fire them at you guys, and you can answer them in whatever way you want. I've just got to find them. Lines, before we get there, you okay?
I'm very much
good.
Okay.
Here comes Debbie. She says, I need to report an assault by a police officer. Any suggestions? She says, when I went to the police station to open a docket, They told me that the person I want to open the docket against was above them in rank, and they laughed when I said I want to open the docket against someone. Bernard is someone who replied to that. He said, go to the charge office, lay a complaint, insist on waiting for your crime register number, insist on getting the SAP legal department contact details. They can't refuse to open a docket. If they try and say they won't, please report it to the IPED. Now, there's a number of questions in there. First of all, what's it like when you go to the police station to report a charge? Genre?
Gary, yeah, thank you for that. That's a very good question from the listener. Well, that sounds to me like a bit of police politics there, saying that the officer who you want to report an assault against is of a higher rank and therefore you are refusing to report it. Yeah, that's a bit laughable. They should always... always, when there's any assault, whether it's an assault by a police officer or a normal civil assault by a resident of our country or non-resident, they should give you a J88 form, and they should take down your details, and they should take down your statement, and they should open a docket. Obviously, that's in a perfect world. I read those comments as well. I'm quite impressed about the amount of knowledge that comes out there. The procedure they suggest to follow is correct. They would like you to, if the charge office refuses, they would like you to see the, make an appointment and see the station commander. And if that fails, they would like you to make an appointment with the cluster commander. Those hierarchies, etc., are all well and good. But it depends on what you aim to achieve with reporting the assault. You may follow that procedure, and you've mentioned IPED as well.
Sorry, before you get to IPED, aren't I obliged, if I've been wrongfully arrested or detained or assaulted or whatever, I have to go immediately to the police station and report it, lest they should suggest that I didn't report it, so it didn't happen.
Yes, well, you would have to report it as quickly as possible.
And if the charge office won't assist me, then I do go to the station commander or the cluster commander. Is that what you suggested?
That's correct. I would always suggest that to protect yourself and to be able to prove it in the end. The key part of the procedure would be to obtain that J88 form and to have a doctor assess you and to note the injuries on that J88 form.
Is that doctor the state's doctor?
It can be any doctor. Usually they suggest one.
Yes.
But you can go to any doctor of your
choice. If I cannot afford a doctor, does the policeman have to send me to the district surgeon, or how does it work?
Yes, they will send you to a provincial hospital here in Pretoria.
Yeah.
If you are assaulted in Pretoria, there are many.
Yes.
You can do it at any of the clinics. We have a wonderful health system everywhere where you can go from a community clinic to a community health center to a provincial or a district hospital.
Okay, so get your medical report as soon as possible. Everyone's nodding in studio. Guys, who wants to tell me what IPED stands for and where they feature in this thing?
Well,
Jean-Ray?
IPED is the Independent Police Investigative Directorate. So it's the police's watchdog. IPED was established in April of 2012, and they are compelled to investigate certain instances of police misconduct. These are the more serious allegations against police, such as the discharge of a police firearm, the assault and torture claims, and then also rape by or any allegation of rape against the police officer, whether on or off duty.
So IPED is investigating their own people.
They are completely separate and independent from the police force.
Yeah.
They report directly on all matters that have been lodged with IPED when a complaint has been lodged. They report directly to the Office of the National Police Commissioner.
Okay.
And they have to give quarterly reports on all the matters. And there's a strict disciplinary procedure that is followed if one is a police officer and you are found guilty in an IPED investigation. Unfortunately, what I have to advise the listeners is, as soon as a matter is being dealt with by one of our courts, IPED will throw their hands up in the air because they are no longer, in terms of their mandate, then required to investigate that matter. So, yes, IPED is a wonderful establishment, but you will not get, in most instances, joy if you want to sue you will not get joy from IPED, because as soon as they learn that the matter is being dealt with by the courts, they will then stop the investigation.
One of the Legal Talk SA members, his name is Rakgabo, he says, don't waste your time on IPED. Find yourself an attorney and pursue a civil claim against the Minister of the Police. Tell the attorney to take your case on a contingency fee agreement. See an attorney as soon as possible, not later than 6 months from the date of arrest. Okay, let's talk about, people are scared to go to an attorney because attorneys are so expensive. Even if I want to sue the police, I'm petrified because I walk through your door and you're going to charge me fees, or aren't you?
Okay, so, yeah, thank you for the question. So how it works usually with matters such as these Minister of Police matters and general litigation matters in general is that legal practitioners will take them on a contingency fee basis. Now, what that means is that us as legal practitioners will enter into an agreement with our clients, which agreement would state that we do not get paid for our services up until such a time as we have been successful with your claim.
Okay, so I can come to you, I shouldn't be scared to knock on your door and no. say to you right up front, a policeman assaulted me yesterday, please will you help me report it to the police, take me to the district surgeon, arrange everything for me. Is kind of you get involved from the beginning?
Yeah, so how it would work is usually we would start with a consultation.
Yeah.
And the potential clients would come in and they'd explain the events that have taken place.
Yeah.
Then we as the practitioners would then assess the merits of the claim. Is there a prospect of success?
Assuming that you get nothing, is it you don't charge me, it's all mahala, and if you, there's nothing, you
get nothing.
And
that's
if you do succeed,
then
you charge me either percentage or you charge me an increased fee.
So,
contingency.
Yeah.
I think we've done contingency, we understand the process.
Yes.
Yeah, lines you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so lawyers like yourselves are taking on the police and other government departments, state departments, on a contingency basis, which is good to know.
Yes.
So the public can feel secure in your hands, truthfully. Yeah.
They should, because even our previous minister used a law firm, so they must be good.
So, Percy asks, how can I claim for an unlawful arrest because I don't have a lawyer that I'm paying? How much will it cost me? I think we've answered that. I've been in police cells for 5 days and I was released through the back door without being taken to court. They told me that there was no DNA on me they had no fingerprints. Therefore, he says, please discuss what lawyers charge or should charge. Well, I think we've answered his question.
But it doesn't say what was he arrested for. What was the charge?
I think he was up for robbery or something. Well, yeah, they said he had committed a robbery.
Oh, okay.
If I could just interject on that one. The purpose of an arrest is always to secure a person's attendance at court. There is no other purpose for an arrest. It should never be used to intimidate or for any other means.
Yeah.
Therefore, the fact that if he is correct on his version that he was detained for 5 days and let out of the back door, they actually violated their own standing orders in not arresting him for the purpose of taking him to court. So if one can then completely with respect disregard what he was arrested for, because the procedure they followed was incorrect. They violated his constitutional rights in a gross manner, and therefore his case would have extremely good merits, and I'm sure I speak for my colleagues here, we would be happy to take on that case.
We South Africa, we're coughing up billions every year, not millions, billions, to settle claims of police misconduct and abuse, which is shocking. I don't know whether this is a political question, really. What are the main causes behind the scourge of police brutality that's gripping South Africa? What's going on out there?
Gary, from my experience, it's by and large the police force that isn't properly trained. There's very few instances where we've actually in court, you know, come across a police officer who knows under what circumstances he can actually arrest a citizen or a person. So the whole training aspect has led to a complete breakdown and misunderstanding of the law so as to when one can arrest a person, when one can detain them. And it seems to be that the standard, by and large, is being lowered on a yearly basis. Mm. The requirements to get into the police force are becoming a lot easier than what they used to be.
There was a joke years ago. It was quite a corny joke. The guy said he got into the police and they asked him what was the requirements. He said they asked him what was 10 and 10, and he said, my answer's 19. So his student said, but that's wrong. The answer's 20. He says, yeah, but I was the closest. Guys, that's a joke. There you go. Okay, guys, yeah. It's been really, really interesting. We get it from you. We understand what you lawyers are about and that you're assisting the public. Yeah, you're making a living at the same time. But I think it's a great service, Lions.
Brilliant.
Yeah, taking these matters on contingency. And, is this a question that you want to take it? Yeah, Palesa, go on.
Palesa, don't be shy. Don't be shy.
There's a case where I was pursuing an RAF settlement and it was awarded 1 million. But then they say they deposited the money into the lawyer's account. And when you contact the lawyer says that your balance is 200,000 rand.
Sure.
The rest was used for legal fees. Is that legal? Are they supposed to deposit it to you or to the lawyer? What?
So if he or she has a legal representative, then usually it's stated in the court order that the capital gets paid out to the attorneys. There should, however, be a reconciliation process that is followed by the attorneys towards the client. So it would depend on what sort of fee agreement she had. Let's assume it was a contingency fee agreement. They would have to draw up the attorney and client and then determine, what is the lesser between the 25% and the
lawyer's bottom fee. Line is the lawyers get the money always so that they can take their cut and they pay the rest over. That's why there have been claims against some lawyers who have taken more than they should or they've dipped their hands where they shouldn't dip. There's one important thing which I like very much. You guys, when you claim on behalf of someone who was wrongfully treated, you ask as part of your court order that the minister file a report with the registrar of the judge's clerk that the policeman who committed the act faces disciplinary action. In other words, not just a payment, there must be disciplinary, and that becomes part of a court order. Love that one. Yes. I've never seen that before. I've only seen it in your papers.
Yes, I mean, it's some way of, trying to correct the wrongs. What you would have seen by and large by the members of the public is that they feel frustrated in that, compensation can never really take away the damage that has actually been done to a person. Mm. And the ultimate sense of justice is that if they can see that there are steps being taken against police officers, be it, a suspension or a firing or any kind of action, it instills a lot more confidence in our justice system, and hence, why we also try and go a little bit above and beyond the norm.
Good. Your website, your firm is Gildenhuys Malatsi. It's not Gildenhuys, Gildenhuys Malatsi, yes. In Pretoria and Sandton.
That's correct.
Please pronounce your name properly. And it's a bit French, so I'm a bit lost.
So yeah. The pronunciation of my name is Anne-Lise. That's my full name. And then it's Nzi Sabira.
Okay, she's a candidate lawyer, and she's striving to become one of these fully-fledged lawyers. Good luck to you.
Thank you very
much, Tim Flock is a very experienced lawyer on this, and so is his associate. Call your name out.
Jean-Ray Pieton.
Excellent. Thank you, Jean-Ray. Thank you, guys. Been very interesting. To our listeners who are listening live, please stick around. We have Kalyani Pillay. She's the CEO of the South African Banking Risk Information Center. She's this time of year, you've got to watch out. The criminals are out to get you. Kalyani will explain how you protect yourself in regard to stolen and fraudulent cards. We'll be right back.
This is CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law. Like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on cliffcentral.com.
I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is The Laws of Life on cliffcentral.com. Alongside me again today is Lionel Mark. Welcome, Lions.
Thank you very much, Gary. Dumela to our podcasters and our guests. A lovely, forever bright, and their energy is just amazing. The CEO of Sabric is in the house, everybody.
She is too. You know, Lions, I found it rather staggering because I was looking at something. I found it staggering to learn that in South Africa, we have over 60 million debit cards and nearly 8 million credit cards in circulation. That's amazing.
No, that's amazing. Where do people get the money?
Well, I don't know where they... Yeah, we'll find out whether they steal these cards or not. But, you know, all these credit cards, obviously, bring challenges and opportunities for criminals.
Certainly.
Sabric has reported that last year fraudulent spend with lost or stolen credit cards has increased by 37%.
Wow.
And this is a major concern to our banks, and therefore that is why we've invited once again Kalyani Pillay. She's the CEO of the South African Banking Risk Information Center, known as Sabric. She's going to tell us all about what's going on, how Sabric is campaigning to keep the public informed. I know that you've told us a million times, but just one more time, a little bit on Sabric.
Thank you, Gary, and hello, Lionel, as well.
Hello, my
Sabric is the South African Banking Risk Information Center, a non-profit organization established by the major banks in South Africa 15 years ago to assist South African licensed banks fight organized crime. And I think one of the things I always say to people, Gary, is that we really should be very proud because we are a very unique organization where competitors come together to fight crime as a collaborative way, which is really great. We're very happy to have the opportunity to empower South Africans and particularly bank customers on how they can protect themselves and more particularly over this particular time of the year.
Yeah, I guess right now this is the time where we have to be extra cautious and extra careful with our credit and debit cards. How does it happen? What's going on out there with these cards?
Well, sure. You know, you spoke about the number of cards that are out there. And, of course, you know, you don't get bank books anymore. So, of course, everybody has a bank account gets issued with a card. And many people apply for more than one. So there are lots of cards in circulation. But what we've been finding over recent times is that it's not a new modus operandi, but certainly doing the rounds again and has been for the last couple of months, is where criminals are actually stealing bank customers' cards right in front of them without them even realizing it. And they're doing this at ATMs. So, of course, you know, when somebody goes to an ATM, they go there because they want to draw cash or they want to do a transaction. So they don't go there just to fiddle around and, you know, and they are usually quite impatient or get a little bit annoyed if the ATM doesn't do what they needed to do. So the example I'll give you is that what we're seeing is that a bank customer goes up to the ATM, inserts their card, and then suddenly sees a screen that looks a little bit different from what they normally used to. And the reason for that is because the perpetrator goes to that ATM before, when there's nobody at it, and they have been setting the screen to cardless transactions.
Can you do that?
Yes. So the banks have actually made it, made various platforms available and for bank customers, all part of their service offerings to make it easier. And of course, if you do cardless transaction at an ATM, then it's a different process that you need to use. And of course, people can ask their banks to explain this. So you don't need to put a card into the ATM. Mm. But of course, you still need your PIN and that kind of thing. So anyway, what they do is they set it to the screen. So of course, the screen looks a little bit foreign because you've not seen this particular screen before. Mm. And you've now inserted your card. So what they do is that they've done that deliberately so that you almost need somebody to come and explain to you or help you with what's going on. Mm. And they very kindly, and I say that in inverted commas, come over to you and offers you that kind of assistance or says to you...
How are these guys dressed? Who are they?
So look, they usually will not make you feel suspicious, let me put it that way. You know, they're usually very nicely dressed. They probably speak well as well. Mm. So what they do is that when they come up to the ATM, now you've already put that card in, we've seen it on footage, they so quickly press the cancel button. So they come up to you, right up to you, they press the cancel button and your card ejects from the ATM, but you don't realize it. Because they're close up to you, they're talking to you, they're telling you, you know, what needs to be done. And in the meantime, they've actually removed this card from the ATM. They either put another one in very quickly or they put nothing in. Now, they're in possession of your card, which, of course, they would put into their pockets very quickly. Mm. They then stand, while standing alongside you and purporting to help you, they tell you to write, go ahead now with your transaction. You can put your PIN number in. It's four numbers, and of course, they want to remember that number. So they're now in possession of the PIN number. They have the card in their pocket. Of course, your transaction's not going to happen because your card's not in the machine. Mm. And so then they would say something along the lines of, well, then you're going to have to go into the bank branch because, you know, something's wrong. And then, of course, you go away highly frustrated. You take this card out of the machine. You put it into your bag without looking at it. It'll usually be the same brand of that particular ATM. Or they'll say, look, the card's jammed. You've got to go and tell your bank so you don't get a card. And what they do is that they go to the nearest ATM away. Obviously, they don't use the same ATM. They go to the nearest ATM to the one that they've just done this. And they need to draw that money very quickly before you detect that you actually don't have your card with you. The other thing that we found that they've been doing, and this has been in very recent weeks, that they're taking this card and they're going into a store and they're buying things with it. Things that they can actually dispose of, that they can resell. So it's part of the laundering of the funds, but obtaining it differently. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the advice to bank customers is absolutely under no circumstances should you take help from anybody at the ATM, irrespective of how well they speak, how well they dressed. If you're having a problem at the ATM, call the bank's call center number. It's usually on the ATM, but if it's not there, you have to have it on your contacts. It's a number that you can't do without. Mm. And for that matter, your mobile service provider's call center number as well. You should keep with you. So call the bank, explain to them what's happened. Alternatively, if your card is still, you're able to get your card out, cancel the transaction, go into a bank branch or go to another ATM, but do not, under any circumstances, take help from anybody.
You know, Kalyani, what you're saying is so obvious, and yet, notwithstanding it, people are making
thousands of people. Yeah.
I know Palesa was like shuddering as you were talking.
Yes.
Because I guess it could happen that there's a person standing behind you, you're a bit stuck, yeah, and they say, no, just push this button.
Yes.
Meantime, he's pushing the cancel button to flip your card.
He's manipulating, he or she is manipulating you emotionally. It's part of the social engineering. They know how you're going to respond. Mm. They know you're going to be grateful to somebody who's offering you help, that you think that this is this kind person helping you get along with what you need to do.
Sometimes you're standing in a long line as well.
Absolutely, and you're frustrated. Yeah, you want
to
get done.
Eventually, you get to the front, and then this thing doesn't work. Yep. So you look to the guy behind you to help.
Yeah.
Lines, I think we know better, but there are a lot of people that just don't. And in the spur of the moment, that emotional decision is what costs people their money.
Yeah.
I read something, I think it's off your website. They say that people use, the crooks use those cards that they steal to buy stuff at liquor stores, service stations, toll plazas, and grocery stores.
Absolutely.
Those are the main ones.
So with the debit cards, that's what actually happens. With credit cards, we're finding sort of similar spend, but also some additional ones. People are buying air tickets. They're buying, booking and paying for holiday accommodation. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes they do that because they can rent it on to somebody else and get some money out of it, you know, that kind of thing. So we're seeing all kinds of spend, but a lot of things around, if you see liquor stores and grocery stores, they can buy goods and they can actually sell it off,
yeah,
you know.
Sure.
So obviously with tolls and things they would pay, and those are smaller amounts, they just pay for it and get away with it, yeah.
Actually, it's also happening at the what you call this, filling stations, where people want to actually fill for you. If you give them cash, they actually swipe it for you. So those are some of the...
It's part of the laundering.
Explain that, Lawrence. I'm not quite with you.
So you get to the filling station, a guy would approach you to say, how much are you filling with? You go, oh no, I want to get petrol for 300 rand. He's like, no, it's fine. I'll pay it for you. Give me the cash. I'll use my card. You give me the cash. So that's
so they obviously in those instances would... we would make, you know, assume that they are part of the syndicate. And if they have a fake or a counterfeit card with them and already have the PIN number, at the end of the day, the employee, the owner of the service station will get payment and is not necessarily a part of this, will get the payment with a fraudulent card.
Oh, I see.
And then, the person who served you has got the cash. I would assume that in that instance, they're really a part of the syndicate that's actually doing this.
I guess, I mean, I know that on your website, you very clearly say, please check your bank balance and your statement
all the time. All the time. And you know, Gary, I think the important thing is that we also encourage bank customers to make sure that they receive SMS notifications for any transaction that occurs on their account, whether it's a transfer, interbank transfer, or whether it's a payment.
Yes.
And it's part of wanting to minimize and the risk that you face and mitigate those losses by if you receive a notification of an unauthorized payment that's gone off, you can contact your bank immediately to ensure that there's no further transactions that take place. So it's very important to get that. But to look at that bank statement, don't even wait for it once a month. I don't even know if banks post it to people anymore.
No, it's mostly
but
online.
Online.
Yeah, yeah.
So go on to again. Make sure that the computer you use is not one in a internet cafe or in a place that you don't know the actual machine.
Yes.
Make sure that when you're logging onto your bank's website, you type in www. And another important thing that people don't realize that we're actually advising, when you're going to your bank, say if you're using your own device that you know, don't just go to the drop-down or to your favorites or to the previous ones and click on that. Get into the habit of typing in the URL, in the address bar, every single time that you need to go into your bank account. Type the www.
Not with smiling because he doesn't do that.
Don't go and do the click on the previous things. Just don't.
We have a minute or so left, Kalyani. What's really important is, what was it I wanted to ask you? If you don't report your lost card very, very quickly, you could be liable to the bank.
If you don't report it quick enough, there's the opportunity of the criminal actually doing more transactions and getting away with it. The bank would require you to report it as soon as possible. But for every single incident and for every single unauthorized amount that's taken out of your account or payment that's made using your card, the bank will investigate every single one individually. If you used any particular device to do your banking or your transaction, the banks will call for those devices as well so that they can perform diagnostics against it to see whether you've been responding to phishing mails or, you know, not having malware on your device or whatever. So I think really important for us to start being really serious about this, you know, taking it seriously and understanding that we are vulnerable as bank customers. And the criminals know that. They know that banks would look after themselves and look after their systems and are constantly at it. But they know that you and I as individuals may not necessarily be taking the same kind of precautions, which creates the opportunity for them.
Good. It's Sabric warns that beware, a skellum is lurking this Christmas season. So please take every precaution.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Sabric is not just a pretty face. Sabric does a lot of good work, and you're around the country constantly telling people how to be careful. And we appreciate what you're doing because there'd be more victims if it wasn't for someone like yourself. Many thanks to you for that.
Thanks so much, Gary.
And we hope to see you again next week.
Yes, absolutely.
Great. It's been lovely. Kalyani Pillay, many thanks for this.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com.